Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour for November 9th, 2023. Many topics to cover tonight. I'll be talking about winter time. Winter time, the winter of 1880. I'll be talking about this and what may have been some of the causes. A very unusual winter, and throughout history there have been extended winters, the famous Maunder Minimum. In which, in the Middle Ages, there were years of cold, of winter, and they couldn't grow crops. The granaries, the way it was set up, especially in the northern European countries, was that the farmers grew the grain. It was very organized, let's put it that way. The farmers grew the grain. They took the grain to market, where it was ground into flour. The usable form of grain, the typically usable form of grain, and then the mills that were running on wind power, by the way, the big, Dutch windmill type of windmills, because these were all over Europe. If you look at pictures of the Middle Ages, there's not a hamlet or town or little farm, sometimes even there, where there was not some kind of wind power going on. But at any rate, the wheat was ground, or the grain. They had many different kinds, of course, of grain. Primarily wheat was ground into flour. Then it went to the bakers, who baked the bread. Okay, so who really controlled it? It got out of the hands of the farmers. It got into a controlled network, and so when the famine hit, with the very cold weather. The farmers didn't have food because they had taken it to market. They had, the ox had taken the load of wheat to market. And who controlled the grain? It was the bakers. And so the bakers said, "Hey, we're not gonna, there's a shortage of grain here." So they kept the food for themselves and their buddies, a few, as far out extended as it could be, family members and good friends. And so there was famine in general because there was no direct, even this could have even been with the farmers because they had lost control of their crops to this organized system, which, interestingly, very much like it is today, where the farmers raise a product. And it's really not in the form it comes off of the farm. It's really not usable. The GMO corn and the soybeans, if you drive across, say, the United States, you see corn and soybeans, mainly wall to wall. So those are the two big products. In other countries, it's very similar where there are farms that grow a crop, but that crop is meant for market. It's not meant for the farmer themselves. In a lot of third world countries, you find smaller farms, up to maybe a few acres, where the people, in a lot of cases, may grow their own food and have a cash crop, and they're very poor. But in a sense, they're very rich, because if the, what hits the fan, they would be better in a better position to maintain than even back in the Middle Ages, where it was very organized. But getting back to the winter of 1880, now this occurred, the famous part of this is in the Northern Hemisphere in what we now call the United States. And so at that point, states were still forming. They were the populations that lived out in the prairie lived on ranches. And they lived in little towns. So they really depended on what was the train traffic at the time. That was the main mechanism of moving goods out west. And so out west being what are now the Midwestern states, the Michigans, the Iowas, the Dakotas, the Midwestern states. And so the trains could not get through. The trains could not get through because there was so much snow. And there's pictures. There was, at this point in time, there were photographs. So we have photographs of this winter. Now, it's started snowing around October 15th, which is very early. And in fact, the 1991 Halloween blizzard, the famous Halloween blizzard, which ripped across the entire northern United States in 1991, snowed 2 days in a row, 36 inches per day, and a horrific storm, which became one of the three pieces of the perfect storm, that hurricane in the North Atlantic that combined three major storm systems and became what is known as the perfect storm. There's actually a movie made about that. But that was at the end of October. And if you're anywhere up in the northern border region and excuse me, of Canada, then, or in Canada, you typically figure that mid-October you better have all your plans made for winter, because it could hit at any time. It could hit at the point where you have to be prepared. Let's put it that way. You don't want to be cutting your firewood in late October. So anyway, but this winter, the winter of 1880, started October 15th, and it did not stop until March. So it snowed literally every day, and not a little bit, but a lot. They had drifts that were 50 to 100 feet tall. And now what happens with drifting is there's some obstruction and the snow starts to pile up. So when the snow comes in and the wind, it keeps piling up and piling up and piling up. And so if you're familiar with Midland United States, Midland America, the farms out there are in the middle of the prairie. They're in the middle of the plains. And anywhere from Ohio, where a lot of the forests were, originally it was forest, but now it's all farmland. And farms will have a row of trees on the windward side, typically to the west, where the wind comes from. And a lot of times, really tall trees, like 100-foot tall trees. And the idea is that if it's going to snow, that's going to break the wind, and anything big in terms of snowfall will fall on the upwind side and protect the farmhouse. And also, there are things called snow fences, but back in the 1880s, there was no such thing as a snow fence. There's a joke about North Dakota. The only thing between North Dakota and the North Pole is a barbed wire fence. And it's really true. If you talk about any of those North Country regions across the United States, they can really get severe weather. And then, but let's get back to 1880 and what really caused this. So people might think, well, it was really a cold winter. And that's not necessarily the case. In fact, if it's a warming period where there's a lot of moisture, why would there be a lot of moisture in the air? Well, that's because trade winds from the south. I always say if the wind is from the south, then it's warm. If the wind's from the north, it's cold. So this idea of global climate change and measured temperature is absurd. Because in a given year, the temperature does not depend on global warming. It depends on what way the wind's blowing. If there's more days when the wind's blowing from the north, hey, it's colder. If there's more days when the wind is blowing from the south, it's warmer. It's very simple. And you cannot, if you don't factor that out of your data, then, your data is corrupt. There are hundreds of factors which affect temperature. And I've also said, too, that temperature is not a measure of heat content. So they're mixing terms. If anybody's a scientist out there, they're saying, talking about global warming, that's heat. That's the amount of energy in the air. That means that energy is being absorbed and not lost. But then they measure temperature to try and prove it, and then equate temperature with heat content, and it's not the same. Temperature is a factor. Excuse me, a little cough tonight going on here. So, I give an example. Take two boxes, exactly the same size that you can seal, sealing boxes, maybe made out of plastic or some material where you can seal these. Okay, you put in the boxes exactly the same air composition. Okay, and so the same amount of oxygen, nitrogen, all of the other kind of CO2, whatever, in your box. Okay, and now get them to where they're the exact same temperature. Okay, now you would say, okay, since the air content is the same, and if you do an analysis based on thermodynamics, then the heat content, the amount of heat energy contained in those boxes should be the same because all conditions are the same. Now what we're going to do is we're going to introduce water vapor, H2O vapor, water vapor into one box but not the other one. And we're going to keep the temperature in that box the same, but we're going to raise the temperature in the box without any HO2 content. Now, which box has more heat content? And it turns out that within a wide range of temperature variation on the box with no water content, if you increase it quite a bit, it still will have less heat energy than the box with the water vapor, because the water vapor has very high heat content. Thermodynamics, very basic thermodynamics. So there's more heat energy in the box with the water vapor, even though the temperature is lower. So temperature is not a measure of global warming, okay? And so if somebody says, oh, the temperature is going to raise 0.0 da, 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 for in the next 20 years or whatever, it's meaningless. Because here's what's going on, and this is relative to the winter of 1880. If you have more warmth, more heat energy, then the water will evaporate from the oceans at a higher rate, putting more water vapor into the air. Okay, that means there's more heat content, but there's more water vapor in the air, and so therefore more snow. So actually, one might think, well, it's got really cold and you had a bad winter. Well, actually, it was probably a warmer winter because of that. Okay, so let's take another look at what factors are involved in snow in a given area. First of all, you need water vapor. So that has to come from the south. That has to be moisture-laden air coming from the south. Then what you need is you need cold air coming from the north. So you need these two weather systems that are meeting, and the cold from the north, the cold air, and then the water vapor, and of course that and the other thing you need, interestingly enough, to have snow is dust. Super, super fine grains of dust. And now, interestingly enough, in the world we live in today, that dust might be in the form of some kind of really dangerous pollution. It might be dust from a windstorm in China or from Asia or from the Gobi Desert that got up in the atmosphere and it's blowing across. Every little snowflake starts because of a grain of dust. And what happens is, now this is how snow really forms, is not really taught properly in standard science. So here's a science lesson for you. Whether you're in kindergarten, grade school, whatever, or you have a PhD in meteorology, in the cloud, what happens is you have movement of charge. Let's just put it that way, because a cloud, in terms of electronics, is a conductor, and so the electric field inside the cloud, and this is very interesting because scientists, let me finish that. The electric field inside the cloud is pretty much zero. And here is why. If you take a metal ball, let's say, and you put it in an electric field, the external electric field, you have a metal ball, which is a conductor. The electrons will move to one side. So the question is, what's the electric field inside the metal ball? And the answer is zero. Because what happens is the electrons will migrate to the side where the positive charge is in this electric field. And that leaves the other side positively charged. And it moves in such a way that the field inside the metal container is zero. Now, scientists always said that lightning forms inside the cloud because of tumultuous action of the winds and up currents and all of this baloney. But then they sent an airplane up into the clouds to measure the electric field, expecting these huge, huge electric fields, and it was zero. Hey, Kay, what's surprise? What a surprise? From a theoretical point of view, knowing what I know, that's exactly what you should expect, because the cloud itself is a conductor. So how can a cloud form lightning? Well, the cloud is nothing but a conduit in the vertical electric field of Earth that goes all the way up to the ionosphere. And that's being charged by currents that pass by Earth coming from the sun. Okay, and so anyway, that'll bring us into a topic here that I'll cover later in the show, where a rocket was recently was damaged in its launch phase because of electrical currents, because of discharging the vertical electric field, in something that they're starting to notice because of all of the launches today, a lot of them happening after dark or around twilight. They're noticing the vapor trail is discharging the vertical electric field, and sometimes it can be damaging, as we know with the second space shuttle failure, which was partly due to what I am told, I can't say any more than that about this, but it was due to a laser beam that some idiot shined on that space shuttle, causing an electrical discharge which burnt the underside of the wing of the shuttle, causing it to come apart as it was in re-entry over the state of Texas. By the way, I just happened to be in the state of Texas on that day. I was on my way to give a talk at the UFO International Conference in Laughlin, Nevada. And I had just gotten down 35W, or 35, it's I-35, I guess, going south into Texas. And I just turned west, and I pulled into a gas station to gas up. And on the monitor there is all the news about this, the space shuttle coming apart, coming in, having problems. And I'm right in the debris field of all this stuff coming down from space. And right away there was indication that a guy had put this on the internet. Excuse me. Hope my voice lasts the end of this show. There was a guy in California whose hobby was, with a very nice backyard telescope, to take a movie of the space shuttle coming in, because he was in, you know, that flight path coming into Edwards Air Force Base. This one happened to be coming into Florida. But anyway, this guy was taking a video of the space shuttle coming in and captured the laser beam hitting the space shuttle. And they were at this guy's, he put it on the internet, and very shortly after, the men in black showed up at his house to confiscate his video. But this all happened in real time, and I was in Texas at the time in the debris field of the space shuttle coming in. And they were going out, they had hunts all over the place trying to find the pieces of this thing, I think. They found a high percentage of the pieces, and of course, a lot of it burned up on re-entry. Okay, so anyway, I got sidetracked a little bit there. But the idea is that in clouds, the electric field is zero. So how do snowflakes form? Well, it's not exactly perfectly zero, because as the clouds are moving and as they're developing, there's this electric current that's within the cloud, and that's not where lightning comes from. The lightning is actually a conduit around the cloud and finding its way down to ground where we live. But that's why they see sprites and jets and elves and all of this other electrical phenomena above the clouds. And that's part of the overall electrical current to the ionosphere. But the cloud itself inside is pretty much has a zero electric field. But in this active atmosphere of the cloud, inside the cloud, it's basically a conductor. It has free electrons. And so the electrons are constantly moving to adjust the electric field inside the cloud so it's zero, just like the steel ball. Okay, so if people are physicists out there and they have a brain, this is not too hard to follow. So how does a snowflake form around a grain of dust? Well, what happens is that the grain of dust discharges the local electric field, just like a comet does in the solar non-uniform electric field of the sun. And that's caused by an excess current of protons. So we know what causes the electric field. In fact, by the way, that was one of the major discoveries I made when I was at Cornell. This is 1979. Because I knew the comets were not dirty snowballs. I knew they were electrical discharge. I knew that the comet nucleus was negative because of all of the characteristics of the comet, and the positive ions coming in slowly in the charge to mass ratio between the charge to mass ratios between electrons and protons and dust particles and larger items that come into the comet nucleus very slowly, and that the electron beam was the majority charge carrier. Okay, so all of these things, and so the end result is that the particle of dust locally discharges the local electric field and gains a small negative charge, just like a comet nucleus. Okay, so what happens then? Then the water molecules, and these are within a Debye distance of the dust particle, that would the Debye distance meaning the shielding distance, and so they come in and they form, and now there's, because of the electrical signaling coming off of that dust particle, the six-sided snowflake forms, and that's a complex problem. I talk about it in my book, Calculate Primes. I actually talk about snowflake development. And there were experiments that guys were doing with creating snowflakes. I'm sorry, I'm losing my voice here. I hope I make it to the end of the show. But anyway, these scientists were trying to duplicate making snowflakes in a vacuum chamber. Or not really a vacuum chamber, but a atmospheric chamber. And of course, they had cold air, they had water vapor, all of the things that you would need. And of course, they knew too that the very beginning of a snowflake crystal was a very small grain of dust, microscopic grain of dust. So they had all these factors in there. And so they would try and grow snowflakes. But the crystals came out just weird. Let's just put it that way. All distorted, just long chains of crystals. And the snowflake patterns were not forming. So I go, what could be the story here? So they put an electric field on this pinhead, and it started forming perfectly six-sided snowflakes. And so the electric field is essential in sending out signals into these six arms so they form exactly the same. And that's a complex structure all on its own. But anyway, I'm not going to go any farther into detail on snowflake production. But anyway, I wanted to let you know how snowflakes form. It's because of the vertical electric field, and the vertical electric field of the Earth is essentially gained from electrical currents that pass by Earth from the sun. The sun is the source of all energy on Earth. And in standard science, people talk about the sun being the source of all energy, but they typically consider it to be the light energy. When the sun gives off light energy or electromagnetic spectrum energy, it's all the way from the microwave, the infrared, the visible light, the ultraviolet, the x-rays, including gamma rays, yes. So that whole spectrum of electromagnetic radiation, people consider to be the source of energy for all plants and everybody else on Earth, humans, animals that eat plants, etc., the food chain. But it's really not true. The second component of energy from the sun, which is much bigger, is the electrical component. And that's completely unrecognized in any form of standard science. If you look at meteorology, we would not have clouds, winds, we would not have hurricanes or tornadoes, we would not have rain, we would not have snow, we wouldn't have any weather that you're familiar with if it weren't for the electrical component. But it's completely unrecognized, just absolutely insane. And it's the biggest energy component on Earth, and it's also not recognized in climate change gobbledygook. They don't recognize the biggest contributor to energy on Earth is not the light that's coming in. It's not the greenhouse effect. It's none of the above. It's the electrical energy that comes in. In fact, the heating of the Pacific Ocean, the El Nino effect, is a heating of the Pacific Ocean that happens just at the surface layer. It's not coming from below. It's just the surface layer of the water, and it happens due to electrical heating of the ocean surface by currents that come down from the ionosphere that are part of the solar system electrical current situation. Okay, so anyway, that's how snow forms. Those are some of the more nitty-gritty details. But in terms of the winter of 1880, you have the winds coming from the south with moisture-laden air. And I grew up in the Midwest, and so I'm very familiar with snow. And typically after a heavy snow, you would have a beautiful sunny day, and that's when everything was clean and kids would go out and play in the snow. We'd play football in the snow, and or just run around or make snow. It's like a circle you would make with crisscrosses. This was a little game kids would play in the snow. You'd make a circle, run around with your boots, make a circle, and then make a cross through the middle, kind of like you're cutting a pizza, and then make another cut through the middle the other way, like you're cutting a pizza, and so you'd have four pieces of the pie. And so the idea is that one kid was it. And so you would run around, and you could only be in the lines that where the snow was matted down, the circle and then the crisscross. And so you would try and run and catch the other person and touch them. And then they were it, and they had to run and chase the other kids. And then sometimes it would be funny because two kids would be crossing at the crossing point or one of the connection points, and then you'd have to find another way to run, and then the person would catch them and tag them, you're it, okay. And little kids could do this for hours. I mean, you know how little kids are. And so we would do this as little kids. Or when we got bigger, we'd play football in the snow. After the Super Bowl game, which was actually started when I was a kid, after a winter game or something like that, we'd go out and play football in the snow. Because when you got tackled, there was a nice big cushion of snow there to fall into. You didn't really get hurt, although I did hurt my knee at one point playing football in the snow. But anyway, that's getting kind of off the topic. Okay, so back to the winter of 1880. So could this happen again? I guess is the big question. Could we have another winter of 1880? We've had incidents like I was talking about the great Halloween blizzard of 1991. So this was October 31st, and this storm came across the northern, the Canadian borderline, and it extended far south, probably into, like, say, Iowa, or South Dakota, and Kansas. But anyway, it was a himmicane, what I call in my work a himmicane. Hurricane is a big cyclonic storm over water. Himmicane is a big cyclonic storm over land. Okay, so the himmicane is going on, and the front side of this vortex, not really a vortex of this cyclonic storm, hit one day on Halloween. And so the backside of the storm came through the next day. So there was like a period of heavy snow, 36 inches of snow on the leading wave. Then there was a beautiful bright day with sun, and that's when the eye of the himmicane was coming through. And then the backside was another 36 inches of snow. And so in the upper Midwest states, the Dakotas, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, these states are prepared for snow. I mean, serious snow. And they got trucks, they got sand, they got salt and sand mixture, and these massive trucks are out, so they have it's a truck with a lot of weight. And these are bigger than your average dump truck, and then they got a big plow on the front. And they're there to clear the roads. So, I mean, they got to clear all the roads, and they start with the major roads, then they start with the secondary roads, and then they start with the all of the roads of every town and city have to be plowed. Good grief. And so it's a lot of work. But after this particular snow, the big trucks could not even get through. They were stalled. And so they had to wait. It took a long time to get dug out from this one. And then, of course, the people seeing that. And then, of course, if you're watching videos, you probably see people who went out too early and they're sliding down a hill, crashing into other cars that are parked, etc. So, anyway, but in the winter of 1880, back to the idea of the train bringing the goods out there, they simply couldn't get goods all winter. And of course, then when all of this melted, what a mess, because then the ground is thawing and the causing flooding with this very quick runoff from everything, all of this massive amount of snow. But it's interesting, just look on the internet, look up pictures, the winter of 1880, and you'll see like trains where they have cut vertically, maybe 50 feet into this snow drift, and there's the little train down there trying to get through. Just unbelievable. But the other issue, like I say, is it wasn't necessarily the coldest winter on record, because there had to be a lot of moisture in the air. But in a constant day to day, this was every day it snowed like a foot or something. It just didn't stop. And could that happen again? And if it happened again, there's clear evidence from the Halloween blizzard of 1991 that the United States would be really hamstrung by a storm of that magnitude again. Because at a certain point, you simply cannot plow out. You simply cannot clear all of the thoroughfares and the freeways. The other thing that could happen today is that they would get out there relatively quickly and start removing the snow and just keep working day and night and day and night for as long as the snow continued. But yeah, months and months of snow on end without stop is unprecedented. Okay, just a few other things. Right now, from what I understand, Russia this fall had a relatively severe winter. But the another issue here is that, for example, the British Isles, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, etc., those islands would typically, even though they're very far north, they have mild winters because of the mid-Atlantic current that comes from the Gulf of Mexico, bringing warm, moisture-laden air. So it's misty a lot and cloudy, but it maintains the temperature. It has that heat content, and that's what I was talking about before. So it's high humidity, It can be kind of a wet cold, but it's not severe cold. It's not winter, and that's what allowed those islands to prosper. In fact, the Scandinavian countries, the same, and even into northern Russia, up in that area, where it can be relatively mild because of the North Atlantic current. Just a quick mention here of Comet 2P Pons Brooks. This comet, I've talked about this recently within the last month or two on my show, that it exploded again, exploded into brightness, so it didn't explode literally, but it increased its brightness by about a factor of 100. And this is the comet that I talked about before, the Horns of the Bull. The Horns of the Bull are an electrical effect, and of course they're still talking about volcanoes on the comet. I mean, what a bunch of clowns. And I explained that if there were volcanoes coming off a comet nucleus, they wouldn't be symmetrical. They wouldn't be timed exactly the same. They wouldn't hold their position in the sky in the relative to the comet's position all the time, because the comet nucleus would be tumbling or spinning on its axis at some point. And so none of these, the idea that they're volcanoes is ludicrous, and only a complete moron would expound that, but that's what you find in standard astronomy. That's something that's been going on. Was this morning, if you happen to see it, there was a visual conjunction between the moon, the crescent moon, and Venus, where they kind of crossed paths. And so anyway, that's if you happen to see that, that's always fun to watch, but it's not a physical alignment, it's simply a visual alignment. Okay, talking again about the Jupiter winds. Good grief. These are still going on. In fact, if you can hear, I don't know if you can hear it through my microphone on this show, but the Jupiter winds are just raging outside. And so anyway, these started about probably a good month ago. And the Jupiter winds are related to our electrical connection with the planet Jupiter. Or I shouldn't say planet Jupiter, it's a small unlit star, it's a small red dwarf star. And but anyway, it discharges the solar capacitor. It has the biggest discharge of the solar capacitor, so when Earth aligns with it, or any of the other planets, by the way, but and this affects our weather, what we get are straight line winds, and they're still going on. So we're still have that connection with Jupiter. So if you're noticing these winds and you're going, where's all this wind coming from? Well, that's it. And we have it in the fall too, which is typically a windy time of year. But the Jupiter winds continue. So what can I say? SpaceX has made its 80th launch of 2023, which is, I think, is amazing, amazing. Remember back in the Apollo days, or the Gemini, or even the space shuttle days, there would be months or maybe even years between launches with NASA. It's just, that's what you expected would be the norm, that after, it would take months and months and months, and engineering, fleets of engineering aerospace corporations all making billions of dollars to make this launch into space happen. And here's Elon Musk with a private company, 80th launch of 2023. And I have to say that if you went back into the US space program and counted up all of the launches cumulatively going back to the say the 1960s, there probably were not more than 80 launches. And so I'm talking about the NASA space program, weatherman, and I'm talking about major launches. I'm not talking about military or where they're using Russian launches. In fact, the United States depended all of its career, including the U.S. military, on Russian launches. When they're looking at big payloads, the United States never ever really had capability on an ongoing basis for heavy launches. So, I mean, The Russians were launching our stuff since the 1960s, in spite of what you call the Cold War, etc. So in terms of actual U.S. launches that were launched by U.S. aerospace companies working for NASA or NASA itself, and of course NASA subcontracted all of this stuff out, really had it oversaw programs, but this stuff was all built by other corporations in the United States. So NASA never really, never really had its own, what you might call, rocket program. But anyway, back to the main point, that if you looked at major launches that were accomplished by NASA since the 1960s, there probably were not more than 80 launches, and SpaceX has already launched 80 major launches in this year up to this point. So that's an incredible feat. And about two a week, that would be about two per week. Absolutely incredible. So they're doing something, and these are international, they're for the other countries, these are military, these are the things for NASA, these are things for private corporations. Wow. Anyway, I may as well mention this at the same time, that Rocket Lab, which is one of the up-and-coming rocket launch facilities, building rockets, had an issue on September 19th where they had a major launch fail to bring into orbit. And, of course, the FAA is investigating this, which I always consider kind of strange, because the FAA, I don't know what they're doing in space. They somehow gain control of any activity in outer space launching from the United States anyway. But this apparently failed because there was an electrical discharge in the main control, so the rockets did not fire properly, is from what I understand. So I may not have that story completely 100% correct. But the understanding that I got out of this is that as it was, this is about 2.5 minutes into the flight, which means it was up there a long ways, had an electrical discharge issue that affected the electronics. And so one thing that we're seeing from all of the launches, because of the SpaceX launches, that the as the rockets cross through, get up into the upper atmosphere and start crossing through the ionosphere, the smoke trail and the rocket, of course, that whole discharge path starts discharging the vertical electric field, and you actually can see it kind of like an aurora. It's an auroral type effect, because what it is, it's high energy particles shooting upwards following that path down. And this is what I've been talking about over and over again when people talk about the space elevator or beaming down electrical energy captured in outer space, solar panels or a Stirling engine or something like that. It's going to discharge the vertical electric field. And it's absolutely crazy. I mean, it's not going to work. So anyway, it appears that the Rocket Lab failure, they can't duplicate it. They say in a laboratory, they're not really sure what caused it. But from my way of looking at this, they need somebody like me on their staff to tell them how to properly build a spacecraft so it can stand or withstand the electrical discharges in the vertical electric field, which they don't know about. And let me tell you something, once people start going into the Van Allen belts, all of this activity that you're seeing, the 80 launches of Musk and the Starlink and everything else that's going up there, this is all low Earth orbit stuff. And nobody is going up into the Van Allen belts. They have geosynchronous orbits, satellites and things like that are going on. But in terms of the majority of activity today, nobody is dealing with this issue of the Van Allen belts, which is a co-rotating electric charge currents orbiting, basically, in a sense, electrically orbiting the Earth. They're locked in a magnetic field, and they're in magnetic orbits, I should say. Not electrical orbits, they're in magnetic orbits. As they charged particles come in from the sun and leak through the nose side of the sun, the sunward side of Earth's geomagnetic field and plasma magnetic field, they are trapped in this toroidal electrical current that surrounds Earth, and it's a battery. It's one of the 17 electrical batteries that I talk about in my weather book. And so what's going on is that they are they can discharge between them if they're triggered. And of course, that's what was going on with when the Russians talked to me about going to the moon back in the 60s. The Russians tried to go to the moon. They didn't want to land on the moon. They just wanted to send somebody around the moon and bring them back. And so anyway, these cosmonauts came back very dead from high levels of X-ray exposure, and that was because of the Van Allen belts. So anyway, and so there's two aspects of it. There's the discharge between the two Van Allen belts, the negative and positive belts, and then there's the actual high-energy particles that are in the belts themselves, especially the electrons which hit something metal and cause X-rays. And that's the issue. That is the issue with the X-rays, the secondary X-rays, the Bremsstrahlung X-rays that are there when a metal spacecraft tries to go through them. Okay. Anyway, next topic. Black Friday, this insanity of trying to sell everything has already started. It started maybe a month ago. Companies already, Black Friday sale, as soon as Labor Day was over. And I'm not going to have a Black Friday sale. There's, anyway, it's just the way things are relative to what I sell, my books and things like that, and the water filter items. And the reason being is because people are getting very good products, and for a very already very reasonable price. And so the insanity. I mean, you cannot pull up an internet page without Black Friday all over the place, and that's kind of a I don't know. I just have a kind of an aversion to making the most sacred, one of the most sacred holidays in the Christian season, which is Christmas, into a sales marketing deal. You never hear Black Friday in the name of Christ. You never hear buy a lot of presents because Christ was born that day. In fact, if you go into a store, you'd be hard-pressed to find anything related to Christ. So anyway, it's part of this pagan atheist society that has emerged from what was once a very successful Christian nation. Just want to mention that on WWCR, we are now on the wintertime frequency. And if you're listening to this show on the archives or someplace else, on one of the podcast feeds or anyplace else, I want you to get a shortwave radio and go to my webpage. There's a subpage, How to Listen. It says radio show, and then there's How to Listen, and it's just been updated. And so the idea is that you should be listening to this show on shortwave radio. And if you get to the point where you can listen to the show on shortwave radio, then sure, go back and listen to the archives if you miss it live, etc. But the whole issue is someday there may not be internet. You know, I have my radio shows archived on my webpage, the jmccsci.com webpage. All my shows are archived. They're there on my Patreon channel. If you want to support me, go to my Patreon channel, and you can do a monthly contribution anywhere from, I think, $5 up to whatever amount you want to support. But that just helps pay the bills. I don't have sponsors. I don't have government support. I don't have people handing me money through the back doors. This is a commercial-free show. And so the other webpage, of course, is JMCC Water Filters, where you get the best water filters on the planet at a very reasonable price, very high quality, things that you will not find anyplace else. Okay. There's, as long as we're talking about auroras and snowflakes from electrical fields and rocket lab, the rocket failing because of electric fields discharging the vertical electric field, there's another topic I wanted to talk about, and that's called SAR arcs, which is a very, it's one of those terms made up when scientists don't really understand what they're talking about. So the term that was given to these phenomena back in the, apparently in the 50s, was stable auroral red arcs, or SARs, which is, by the way, the same mnemonic as the one of the man-made diseases infused into the population. So I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about electrical phenomena that you see up in the sky, SARs, stable auroral red arcs. And so basically, what's going on here is that the vertical electric field, these occur away from the North Pole. Your typical auroras occur at the poles. And so the ring, there's a ring current around the North Pole, and that's where the electrical particles come in, following the magnetic field lines that give us the auroras near the North and South Pole. But there are other atmospheric phenomena that are seen as far south as, say, Texas or even Mexico. And these are electrical discharges, the same ones that are being caused by rockets. And so these are electrical discharges that work their way down to the surface of the Earth, because it is part of the overall electric field of the Earth. And so I talk about this in my weather book, The Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun-Earth Weather. Sounds like a complicated title, but this book was written for the general public and for scientists, and to understand weather from an electrical point of view. And it starts out by talking about the fact that on Earth we would not have any form of weather if it were not for the electric fields, like I was talking about earlier. Just a quick mention here. This came up, I was talking about astrology, and I was a guest, of course, every Wednesday morning on John Moore's show, and this idea of astrology came up, and so I was talking about the scientific basis for astrology that we developed. I worked with Russian psychologists. They were started attending the meetings, the daily meetings, that at the University of Novosibirsk in central Russia, and dealing with the electrical nature of the solar system. And anyway, it came up, I was mentioning that there was a physical basis for astrology based on the electrical nature of the solar system, and that people, and the study that these psychologists were doing was with fetuses that were still unborn in the womb of the mother, and they were making measurements, and they were reacting to the alignments of the planets, etc. So they knew this was going on. And so anyway, John said, well, in the Christian beliefs, astrology would be kind of like a devil worship, that somehow the stars influenced things or whatever, positions of the planets, etc. And I mentioned that the Christmas story, which is coming up, the three main characters, apart from the little shepherd boy that came to visit Christ, were the three magi, who are astrologers. So anybody that wants to deny astrology in the terms of the you know, these guys were watching the sky and independently came to the decision that this was a signal that they had been waiting for thousands of years, that the Magi had been born, and was actually, and when they saw it, was about to be born. And they went on this long, arduous trip, finally meeting up on their trip, coming together and meeting up with Herod, who knew too, because of astrology, that the Magi had been born, and then continued on, of course, the Three Kings story, the major, major, major part of the entire Nativity story. Okay, so at any rate, just wanted to mention that, yes, astrology was alive and well in the Bible, and it is very much a significant part of it, that the life and death and the many of the different aspects of Christ's life were related to predictions based in the one even talks about the end days. He talks about, look at the signs in the heavens. I mean, and we're not, of course, what he's talking about is the large comet coming to cause destruction on planet Earth. You know, so if, you know, he's talking about signs in the heavens. And it's, so you have to understand that astrology has a real meaning if you understand what's going on. And it's not a devil worship or anything like that. It's understanding the physics and the psychology of astrology, including the full moon. We were talking about that, how the craziness goes on at the full moon, at peaks, etc., and on and on and on. So just to remind you once again that the best water filters in the world are in my product line, JMCC Water Filters. Webpage is jmccwaterfilters.com. And go there. And like I say, you won't find a Black Friday sale. Sometimes people say, will you have a sale on or something like that? But using this coupon code, you can get a 5% discount. It's JMCC. Use that coupon code for an extra 5% off. And I think that if you, all I can say is that I get rave reviews when I hear back from my customers, and they're my best advertisement. That's all I can tell you. And then also on Amazon, my latest book, The Real History of Man and Earth, Myths, Magic, and Mayhem, that's available on Amazon. Also available in ebook format on my webpage, jmccsci.com, along with my entire library of books. And I'm out of time. We'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.